My name is Daisha Clay. I'm the audio librarian here at Classical 91.7. While I'm a real librarian, I have a deep, dark
secret.
I know very little about classical music. I grew up listening to rock. And I know something about jazz. But when it comes to classical, the thing is, I want to learn. And as it turns out, I work with people who know a lot about classical music. Every week on this show, one of my coworkers will give me a homework assignment, a piece of classical music they think I should know, and then we'll discuss it. Come learn with me in the classical classroom. Hello, and welcome to the Classical Classroom. I'm Daisha Clay, and you may remember my instructor today from such Classical Classroom episodes as Steve Reich's Piano Phase. Welcome back, Daniel Webben.
Hi, thanks.
Yeah. Daniel lives like a quintuple life. He's a graduate student at the UH Morris School of Music, where he's studying composition. He also teaches there. He works by day as a Classical 91.7 Music Lab intern. At night, he moonlights as a jazz drummer. And then on weekends, he plays drums for a church. Daniel, it is so good to have you back, and I'm so stoked about what we're going to be talking about today, which please explain.
Well, as you heard, that was Run DMC, who had remixed Aerosmith's Walk This Way, and I want to talk about remixing, or borrowing someone else's ideas and making them your own, which I think about the 80s and sampling with that, but turns out, historically, that's one of the oldest compositional tricks in the book. Goes back 1,000 years to Hildegard, you know, the first composers were doing this sort of thing. So I kind of wanted to take us through a little walk of through history of remixing.
This is very, very exciting. So when you say remix, define the terms, because I mean, you know, I understand what that means in a contemporary sense where, you know, you've literally got samplers, you've got recordings mm-hmm. of stuff and people are playing it back and they're, you know, manipulating the recordings and stuff like that. What does that mean in a classical music sense?
Well, you know, lately it could mean that too, because classical musicians, they're privy to all the technology going on. So, you know, it's not just the rock and pop guys that get to use sampling. Steve Reich would sample things, and Paul Lansky and those guys. But before that, you know, we think just notes and pen and paper, anything that was already written, either by you or by someone else, or just a folk song that has just been around, that you take it and you integrate it into your music. You know, that's kind of my broad definition of remixing. You could also call it quotation. You could call it borrowing, mm-hmm. but it's all the same idea. You know, mm-hmm. you're using something previously done, and you're using it in your music. And composers do it for a number of reasons, and sometimes it's to make a bold statement, or sometimes it's to be witty. So mm-hmm. it's a very cool thing, because it's introducing this extra musical element. And when you do that, it opens up a whole realm of possibilities that are pretty cool.
Okay, got it. Well, let's go ahead and get like right to the music, because we have a lot of ground to cover.
Okay,
so what are we going to be hearing first?
Well, the first piece we're going to hear is a piece by Mozart, but that's from the, I wrote it down, the 1780s, 1785, around there. But before that, I wanted to just sing a little thing. When we think about taking someone else's material, if you had to put your money on what has been done the most, it would be actually a chant melody from the early church. It's the Dies Irae, which is da 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 da, the Dies Irae mm-hmm. melody. And there it is. Medieval composers used it. Mozart used it. Brahms used it. Modern guys have used it. Michael Dougherty. Stephen Sondheim uses it in Sweeney Todd. I don't even think you could find a number for how many people have used this melody, but, you know, in the thousands, I would imagine. Mm-hmm. So, you know, right there, you set a precedence for this. And then when we get to Mozart, we're going to see someone using another familiar melody, but not from the church. So this is going to be a children's melody. So the Mozart is A vous dirai je maman, mm-hmm. which in French is a children's song, but we all know it as Twinkle Twinkle Little Star or Ba Ba Black Sheep or the alphabet song. And okay. Mozart's going to take that melody and do a variation on it. So that's the theme. Other than the little mm-hmm. trills, he hasn't changed it.
Yeah.
But now he has.
Yeah. So he took that song from an old French song, I'm assuming, and talk about what he's done with it. Talk about...
Well, he's going through a set of variations. This is 12 variations, and they're going to be all different types. This one is very fast and fleeting, mm-hmm. but you can still tell that the melody's there. Now we get another one.
So brilliant. So yeah. he took this simple little song
yeah.
and was like, I'm just gonna play on this theme.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now we get the third one. He's kind of showing off. You know, Mozart was very witty, very clever, and especially when you use a melody that everyone knows, it's kind of like, watch what I do with it. Mm-hmm. You know, there's some showing off. There's a little bit of right. cockiness. And it comes through. Because you're kind of like, ooh, I wonder what he's going to do with it next.
Uh-huh. It's just like Timbaland taking that Nina Simone song.
Yeah, yeah. And yeah, so some of them are big and bombastic. Some of them mm-hmm. are playful. Variations are a lot of fun for that wittiness to them. But mm-hmm. even more so when you're using someone else's melody. Mm-hmm. I think it gives you a whole other level of kind of audience involvement and engagement. Yeah. So it's a great trick as a composer.
Tell me a little bit about variations. I mean, so one of the things that I'm always curious about when I'm talking to my instructors in the classical classroom is mm-hmm. what do these different terms mean?
Right.
So I know now what a tone poem is,
right,
kind of what a symphony is and movements are and that. So tell me about variations as a musical term.
Well, variation is not, it's pretty simple. You take an idea and then you say, okay, what are the musical parameters I mm-hmm. could change while still recognizing this idea? I could change the tempo. Mm-hmm. I could change the volume, the dynamic. I could change the key. Mm-hmm. I could change the mode. I can make it minor or I can make it major. I could, you know, flesh out the melody with more notes and kind mm-hmm. of in between them, or I could simplify it and make it like just like the important notes, but I could still recognize it. Mm-hmm. So, and you know, it doesn't matter what melody you have or where you are historically as a composer, you know, what your language is, the musical parameters are the same, really.
Is this something that's pretty common? I guess that's more what I mean.
Oh, yeah.
Like, is that something that a lot of composers do?
Absolutely, or? Absolutely. Okay. It's one of the major forms. You know, okay. you have like sonata forms and rondos, but then theme and variation is like a huge form. Tons of composers have them.
Okay.
And if we back up to Renaissance and Gregorian chants and that sort of thing, someone would write a chant melody and then someone else would elaborate on it. And then someone would go back and take all those elaborations and put words that fit with those melodies. Mm-hmm. So variation is one of the most common ways of, you know, of remixing, kind of like what we're talking about.
Okay. All right, so what do you have next?
Well, next we're going to jump ahead 100 years, and this is Mahler's First Symphony, Third Movement. And I wanted to do these two back-to-back because he's going to also use a children's melody, but totally different. Mozart is going to do a bunch of variations on it. Mahler is going to change one thing about the melody to make it his own and then craft the whole movement around it. Okay. So you're going to hear the tune Frère Jacques, again, a French tune, but Mahler is going to make it minor and super creepy. So this is Mahler's First Symphony, Third Movement.
Okay. It
starts off with a bass solo.
Oh, God.
Yeah, I know.
I'm just seeing this being used in a movie montage about a murder or something.
What I think is so interesting about this is that the fact that you know what the melody is supposed to be, mm-hmm. and you know that he's changed it, gives it a whole new context. If you didn't recognize his Frère Jacques, you'd be like, well, that's sort of creepy and weird, but not that much. But the fact that you know it's this sweet little children's tune mm-hmm. that he's twisted gives it a whole new context. Makes it so much creepier.
Right, yeah.
So that's that extra musical element that quotation and remixing or can introduce into the music.
I see. Why? What do you think he chose this tune? Why do you think he decided to go creepy?
Well, Mahler quoted a lot of, he would quote himself. He wrote a lot of songs, and he's always kind of fascinated with using song melodies in his symphonies.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's part of that. As far as this particular one, I don't know if he had association with it as a child or anything, but it's super, super effective. I mean, I can't imagine, it's the perfect song to use. I can't imagine it being done with any other song. And not every song would lend itself to being changed to a minor key mm-hmm. as well as this one does. It hits just the right notes that you can just change two notes, a third and sixth scale degrees, and completely change the mood of the whole thing.
Right. Yeah. It is very effective because, I mean, from the moment it opens, it's just like this doomy sort of is doomy a word? Doom and gloom sort of mood just settles on your ears, you know.
Well, he's writing towards the end of the 1800s, and about that time and going for the next 30-40 years, we have this idea of the grotesque mm-hmm. or the macabre kind of becomes a thing that a lot of composers and writers and artists we're very conscious of. So it has a little bit of that, you know, when you think of a gargoyle with its faces contorted and distorted and the grotesque, and it has this like creepy Ferris wheel march happening. So he's sort of playing on that idea of the grotesque.
Okay. All right, so where do we go from Mahler?
Well, from Mahler, we're going to jump ahead 50, 60 years to Shostakovich, who's going to be using, he's going to be quoting things, but it's stuff that he wrote himself.
Okay.
And again, this whole idea of quotation or remixing allows you to kind of make an extra musical statement.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of Shostakovich's music was censored. He lived, you know, during the Soviet Union, during a really rough period, and Stalin and all that, and he from time to time was in the graces of the party and then would fall out of grace with the party.
Yeah.
And this wasn't a laughing matter. I mean, people were killed. People were exiled to Siberia for being on the wrong side of the party. And in Shostakovich's music, he sort of retreats into himself, with the quartet and chamber music being really his outlet for what he really wanted to say. And then his symphonies and operas and stuff and his film scores being maybe a little more public, a little more appeasing to the party. So we're going to hear his eighth string quartet, third movement, and he's quoting quite a few things. He's quoting from his symphonies and from his piano trio, but mainly from his opera, Lady Macbeth of the Mtsensk District, which was the piece that got him censored. It was the first piece to really get him in trouble with the party. Mm-hmm. It was a big hit, and then Stalin saw it and denounced him. And it fell from grace, and he was, you know, everyone's favorite composer. And then all of a sudden, you're a formalist. You know, you're not writing music for the people. And so he's quoting that in this quartet. So it's like, I get to use my music anyways. I get to have it out there anyways. So he's making a pretty bold political statement here.
Well, I usually don't study too much about the composers before we do a show because, you know, I like to learn as we go. But I did happen to read a little bit about this piece. And wasn't this written right after he very reluctantly joined the Communist Party? And I read that, you know, like, it was a really dark period for him.
Absolutely.
And that he actually, at least according to his daughter, dedicated the piece to himself.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess what he really wanted to do, that, like, he was going down this road that he was sort of forced to go down.
Right.
And he was sort of, I don't know, it kind of sounds like he was maybe bidding his past life and his ability to do what he wanted to do goodbye.
It could be. I took a whole course over his quartets, and it's all kind of jumbled in my mind over which ones he dedicated to who and and where he did all this. I do know he wrote this one in like 4 days, and he was supposed to be writing a film score for a sort of propaganda-ish film, you know, a big bombastic for the people film score. And he was procrastinating and wrote this quartet instead. So I think right there, you can make a very strong case that this is music he wanted to write in the midst of having to write stuff he didn't want to write.
I see.
It's almost angry, and there's this kind of like fervor and maybe fury to it. And then on top of the fact that he's quoting his own music, which was, it was banned, I think makes a pretty strong case for what the power that quotation and remixing and borrowing can really have.
It's hard to imagine classical music being banned, but
oh yeah,
that's really,
I know,
man, that says a lot about the time that he was living in
for
and
sure.
Where he was living.
Let's listen to that for a little bit. It's biting and satirical and all of these things that are, I don't know, I would have no reason to write them myself because I've never been censored, but, well, I have a kind of, I would say privileged life, but nothing, my music's never been censored. I didn't grow up in a communist state.
There's no threat of you being sent to a gulag anytime soon.
Right. but, you know, Shostakovich has to tread very carefully. Right. When he makes these statements, and so his quotation was kind of a way for him to do that. So the, you know, there's this element of like being sly or being slick and clever with it that the borrowing allows you to do.
Yeah,
I think.
Yeah, it reminded me a lot of music from like a Tim Burton movie, like Edward Scissorhands or something like that.
Yeah,
and that sort of, because Tim Burton has that same sort of sarcasm, his commentary on modern
and life. Especially him, you know, kind of like with the Mahler, this obsession with the grotesque things not being quite right, and quoting helps you with that because you have a norm for this is what it should be and this is what I've done with it. You know, and the difference between those two, you know, there's kind of like a world of statement right there.
It's really cool, like what I'm seeing, that quotation and remix allows you to explore that maybe other forms.
Right. And the next one we're going to hear is even another facet of that. So we're going to jump, actually the same, within a year, 1959, but in America, Miles Davis, the trumpet player, paired with Gil Evans, who's an arranger, and they put out an album of Porgy and Bess. So it's Gil Evans's like reimagination of a lot of tunes from Gershwin's 1935 opera Porgy and Bess.
Mm-hmm.
So the same idea here of borrowing in quotation, but totally different reason they're doing it.
Yeah.
So let's listen to a little bit of the original Porgy and Bess. This is Gershwin's Porgy and Bess. This is what he wrote.
Okay.
This is 1935. Yeah, so this melody here is what Miles is going to play.
Okay.
Bless you is my woman now. You is, and you must laugh and sing and dance for two instead of.
So let's jump ahead and see, this is radio. Yeah. Let's hear what Miles interpreting Gil Evans' score has done with that melody, Best okay. You Is My Woman Now. Miles is so great at singing through his trumpet. You know, he inflects just right to really get the lyrics across without saying them. But to me, it's special because I know the melodies from Porgy and Bess, and then I hear what Miles and Gil Evans did with them, and that kind of dichotomy, that difference between the two is so much fun for me.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Gershwin occupies this unusual and very special place in American repertoire, which I think is why a lot of his tunes have become very standard in the jazz repertoire.
Yeah.
And I think Miles gravitated towards that when he, you know, because if you're going to make an album of someone else's music, you need to think pretty carefully, like, whose music is it going to be?
Mm-hmm.
You know, if I'm going to remix or quote or sample someone else, who am I going to sample?
Uh-huh.
You know, and so Gershwin was the perfect choice for Miles. And this particular album is so brilliant because Gil Evans is simultaneously completely truthful to the melody. He doesn't actually change the melodies at all, but he shades it and he colors it and he puts them in different contexts. And he really kind of gets inside of what's going on and explores kind of the wealth of possibilities in what Gershwin wrote in ways that Gershwin didn't explore.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. You made that correlation between what Mozart is doing and what Miles and Gil Evans are doing, and I'm thinking, wow, I can really see that.
I can totally see
that taking just a sort of basic idea, deconstructing that, reconstructing it,
turning it
inside out, that idea goes all the way back to Mozart is pretty fascinating.
And even, you know, even beyond that, you know, taking someone else's material or your previous material, and you can do anything with it.
Yeah.
And you can use it for any purpose, you know, political or aesthetic or to be clever or be funny.
Mm-hmm.
But it definitely gives the music an extra layer. And I think especially for people that are just getting into classical music or just getting into jazz, variations and jazz guys playing standards is a really great way to kind of get your brain thinking about the kind of intellectual rigor and like the mental aspect and the mental tricks that the composers are throwing at you.
Yeah.
To me, that's kind of where all the fun stuff in classical music is. But if, you know, you have to know maybe just like a tiny bit to really get it. And then you're like, oh, now I can see he's toying with me.
Yeah.
As an audience member, and he's going this way, and he's going this way, and I can see what he's doing. And that's a lot of fun.
Yeah, I can see that being a really great instructive tool. So you pick somebody that you like who's doing a variation on someone else, and then you take off from there and study what that person was doing. You study their variations. You can kind of leapfrog like that.
Yeah, yeah.
Back in time.
And I think there's a reason that all composers have at least one theme variation that they've published. Yeah. Like, I could not think of a composer that hasn't done it at least once.
That's so neat. So what's, I think this is our last piece. What is...
Yeah, this last one kind of brings it all together. This is Luciano Berio's Sinfonia, which he wrote in 1969 for the 125th anniversary of the New York Philharmonic. So, I mean, of things that happened in 69 or 70 in New York, this was the thing, you know. Huge commission, enormous work, required the full orchestra plus 8 singers. And the singers weren't just operatic singers or pop singers, they were the swingle singers, who were, I don't know if you've ever heard of them, they're really, really famous in their time. I think the group is still around, not the same people though. And they would do pop and rock and jazz and classical things, all with their voices, kind of like an early virtuosic a cappella group.
Okay.
And so they sing, they talk, they kind of shout things. It's just huge collage of pieces. And Berio quotes easily 100 or more different things from the classical repertoire, and he layers them in different ways, and it creates, really the best term is a collage of music, and it's all quotation. That's all he's doing in this piece. And it's funny, it seems so modern because it's hard to imagine him doing it without sampling, but it's all done on a page, which makes it even more amazing to me. But when you listen, you'll be like, how did he do that without Pro Tools?
Well, and he's also taking from, he's directly quoting authors as well, like Samuel Beckett and other people like that.
Yeah, he uses a lot of text from Beckett.
That's the stuff that they're yelling out.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Okay. Absolutely. So let's listen to a little bit of that. Yeah. And it's pretty trippy.
Okay.
So that waltz you hear underneath everything, that's the scherzo from Mahler's Second Symphony.
Oh.
And that's going to underscore this whole movement. And then all these other interjections and quotations and text is going to be kind of put on top of it.
Okay. It's like the musical interpretation of a traffic jam.
Yeah, and you can hear the Mahler all the way through there, just bubbling along like a stream or something, or to me, it's almost more like driving in traffic, you know, like I'm in the car, Mahler Second Symphony, home base, and then I'm seeing like, oh, buildings and other cars. And
people honking.
Yeah,
people,
street signs I should have paid attention to when I took a turn.
And instead, I wound up in Bizarro Land.
Yeah. But it's almost a name that tune a little bit too.
Uh-huh.
Like this moment right here, I recognize. There was like it was Lemaire or Stravinsky, Rite of Spring. But it's kind of fun, especially if you're a music connoisseur, you'd be like, oh, that's that, oh, that's that, oh, that's that, you know, and it's kind of guess the tune that he's thrown in there. Or, you know, if you're a literary person, you'd be like, oh, that's Beckett, oh, that's, you know, whoever, some other poet.
So you said that Berio kind of brings it all together, like this whole idea of the remix, and like...
Yeah.
Do you mean just because he's doing it so clearly, purposefully, he's just being outright with it?
Yeah, well, he's sort of taken it to the nth degree.
Yeah.
You know, there's very little of things there are bits, connective tissues that he wrote, but most of it stuff other people did. But I think he brings it together in the sense that all the different kind of philosophical or emotional reasons one might quote someone else or one might remix someone else, he's dealing with all of those.
Yeah.
You know, there's satire, for sure.
Yeah.
There's like wit, and there's a cleverness to it. There's kind of this idea of throwing the audience a bone and be like, here's something you recognize, and now watch what I do with it, how I play against it. And then kind of what Miles and Gil Evans did, there's also kind of getting inside of something and really like exploring it. What are the possibilities and fleshing it out? Because like he'll have the singers punctuate what Mahler did, or they'll kind of actually at some point they yell or they say text from the score.
Yeah.
You know, that's like crescendo or diminuendo or whatever. And like they say that when it happens in the score, you know, so it's almost like he's got inside of the score.
Yeah.
You know, a little bit. So all those different facets and different reasons why one might quote, you know, he's done all of them kind of all at the same time, which is a little helter-skelter, but it's fun.
It also seems to me, just you know, not knowing this piece very well, as if he's sort of poking fun at the idea of the remix, of the variation.
A little bit. And, you know, he's writing this in, what did I say? Oh, in 1969. So, you know, we've had the real heavy avant-garde movement. And yeah, he's definitely poking a little bit of fun at maybe the deconstructionist, you know, movement, or the like Dadaism, or the absurd. But yeah, he's doing it by doing it too much, you know.
Yeah.
Challenging the idea of like what is classic music and what is, you know, and he's challenging it by quoting the best of the best of classic pieces. I mean, there's Rite of Spring in there, there's Lemaire, there's Beethoven's Sixth Symphony, there's Strauss's The Rosenklavier. I mean, these are like heavyweight pieces, and then he's just using them, chopping them up and sticking them in whenever he wants, you know? And it makes it fresh too. You know, I've heard Mahler's Second Symphony plenty of times. I've played it, and hearing this, it's like, oh man, that's, it's not even the same thing. It's totally different.
Revives it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For sure.
I like it.
Yeah.
So, all right, I'm convinced that the remix goes way back. I get it.
Way back.
I you shined a light on and its importance. I guess the way that, as a contemporary person, I think about it is just sort of like hip-hop artists use it to create a melody in an otherwise not very melodic song. But I see now how it is an extremely useful tool for composers and for musicians and, God, for everybody, really.
Yeah,
I mean, anybody creating anything.
Yeah, and it's really a labor of love, too, because I think it's pretty high honor to remix something.
Yeah,
you know? Like,
it's like saying, this is legit.
Yeah.
This is a classic.
And this means so much to me, or this has so much worth and so much meat to it that it can mean things beyond what it originally meant. It can mean this, or it can mean this, and I can use it in these contexts, and it still has weight.
Yeah. I love that. I love the idea that, I mean, music commenting on itself creates this sort of meta-ness.
Yeah. I was hoping you'd say the word meta, because, you know, I'm very into Arrested Development and TV shows like this that have all this like self-referential humor and meta humor and, you know, Seinfeld or things like that. And music totally has that, you know, if you know where to look. And if you're the kind of person that really likes that sort of humor or likes engaging your brain in that kind of meta narrative way, there's tons of music out there that you would totally be into because it does that. It engages your brain in that sort of manner.
Well, Daniel, I really appreciate you coming back to this show. You always have like a unique outlook on music, and I really enjoy it. This was great.
Thanks for having me. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah. All right, listeners, if you have any burning musical question that you would like addressed on the Classical Classroom, feel free to email me at dclay@classical917.org. And thanks a lot for tuning in. We'll catch you next time.